For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, we're going to be studying Hebrews 11, verse 8 through 19. And in particular, we're going to be looking at Abraham's faith. We're going to be given snapshots of Abraham's life by the author of Hebrews. But before we jump into this, I don't want us to lose perspective here. Remember that the entire chapter of Hebrews 11 is framed in verse 1, where the author says, "Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see." So unlike faith that people think of today, biblical faith is not just wishful thinking. It's not creative thinking where we just hope that this thing happens and boom, it appears. But that it's faith that is directed towards something that is actually true, that's objective. And the author of Hebrews also goes on to say that it is being sure of what's hoped for and certain of what we do not see. That's a theme that we see throughout the entire chapter. That these characters who show up, these Old Testament heroes of the faith, often were called on to believe and trust in God even though things didn't seem like God was actually going to come through. And so there was the situation that they were faced with, what they could see, and then there was the unseen, which is what God promised. And so throughout, he weaves that into the narrative. All right, let's look at the first story that he's going to bring up, which is Abraham's calling. Starting in verse 8, "By faith Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, he obeyed and went, even though he didn't know where he was going." So a little bit of introduction about this guy Abraham. This dude Abraham lived around 2000 BC. So he lived over 4,000 years ago. He lived in this area called Ur of the Chaldeans, which is probably located near the Mesopotamian Valley or Basin, which would be modern-day Iraq. This city, Ur, actually is a historical site, and most scholars believe that Ur has been uncovered and excavated, a very ancient city. And we're told that this guy Abraham got this calling from God. God appears in a vision and says, "I want you to get up and go, you and your entire family." This is recorded for us in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, where God says to Abraham, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land that I will show you." So here's Abraham, and God shows up on the scene, this foreign God that nobody had ever heard of, and he says, "I want you to get up, you and your family, and I want you to go to this land that I'm going to show you." And we're told that he didn't know where he was going. So that's pretty crazy. You know, as he's packing up his stuff, as he's packing up his family to go, you know, he's like, "God, so where are we going to go?" And he's like, "West." And, you know, Abraham's like, "Okay, that's good, but can you be a little bit more specific? And he's like, "That way." And he's like, "All right, well, okay, I'll do it." And so he gets up, he packs up his bags, and he leaves this place that he had lived all his life, that probably generations of his family had lived in, and decides to follow God and go west. Now, it's an interesting detail that he didn't know where he was going. You know, I think that for most of us, this is pretty tough to imagine. You know, it's pretty hard to believe that we would go to a place that's unspecified, partly because we want to ruthlessly control our lives. You know, normally when God calls on us to do something, we want a blueprint. We were like, "Okay, can you just like lay out some of the details, and then maybe I'll agree to what you're saying here. And often God doesn't lay out the details for us. He's just like, I want you to go. And I think the reason he does this is because he wants to try to pry our controlling fingers off of the wheel of our lives and allow him to start driving, to let him start navigating us in the direction he thinks is right. And so this can be very hard. I know for me, this is definitely one of the more difficult things for me to do, is to let go of control and allow God to take me in an unknown direction. And one of the best ways for him to actually build our faith is to throw us in a state of confusion where we don't know what we're doing, we don't know where we're going. And God's saying to us, look, if you want to get through this, the only way that that's going to work out is if you trust in me, trust in my faithfulness, trust in my promises. You know, I think about, wanting to have everything laid out for you. And it reminds me of my son. You know, I got a 3-year-old son and a 9-month-year-old. And me and my eldest son have kind of a routine that we've established over the last year, where we go to McDonald's down on campus. We get a parfait. And then normally we walk down on campus, or we go down to the ravine there at Whetstone and throw some rocks in the water or whatever. We do this every single week, and we've been doing this now for a while. But I remember the first time I suggested this to him, you know, I was trying to really build some anticipation and excitement. I'm like, Julius, so we're going to go to this place called McDonald's. And he's like, what's Old McDonald's? I'm like, no, it's McDonald's, not Old McDonald's. I tried to explain to him. I'm like, this is a restaurant that contributes to adult obesity. he's like, well, what's obesity? I'm just like, never mind. It doesn't matter. And, so on the car ride there, he's asking me a million questions. He's like, are we there yet? What's a parfait? You know, imagine trying to describe what a parfait is to a 2.5-year-old. It's really tough. And, finally, I'm just sort of like, look, stop asking questions. It's going to be awesome. Promise. And it doesn't matter if you know where we're going or when we're getting there. What matters is that I know where we're going. And so likewise, God says to us, look, don't concern yourself with where I'm taking you. If I explained it to you, you wouldn't understand anyways. It'd be hard to really describe how awesome it is. And so God insists that we let go of control of our lives and give it over to him. And, God might be calling on you to let go of control in your life. Maybe he's calling you away from something. And that might be difficult for us because we're not sure of all the details. But God can actually use this incredibly in our lives, where when he calls on us to do something, to trust in him, he can do things that really we would never be able to imagine. I think about one of my close friends who is also a sphere leader and an elder in this church. His name is Scott Risley. He was in a situation where he had this incredible career. He was like a honor student throughout high school. He graduated in his undergrad at OSU with honors, got his master's degree in computer science engineering. And after college, he got hired on with this, startup software development company, making tons of money. And then one day he gets a phone call from someone here at our church. It's like, hey, we want to hire you on part-time as a teacher. And, he describes how confused he was. He didn't know. He felt so much uncertainty, but he felt at the same time that God was calling him to take this step of faith. And so he did the unthinkable. He decides, okay, I'm going to go and do this. So he quits his job. Imagine telling your boss, yeah, I'm quitting this job here, and I'm going to get this part-time job at a church. They must have just thought to themselves, like, what is he doing? It's crazy. And, you know, years later, he got hired on full-time as a sphere leader. And today, since then, literally thousands of people's lives have been impacted by him. I'm sure during those years when he had a part-time job, he wasn't sure how he's going to pay his mortgage. He wasn't sure how he was going to pay his bills. That there was a level of uncertainty there. And yet, because he trusted in God, God saw him through and was able to do something amazing. We're told in verse 9 and 10, by faith he made his home in a promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents as Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. So Abraham decides to do the unthinkable. You know, he decides to get up, pack up his family, pack up his stuff, pack up his herds, and he decides to go west. And, you know, you can imagine he probably sold all the stuff that he couldn't take with him. Probably had a big garage sale, moving sale. His neighbors were probably sitting there, you know, as they're rummaging through his stuff, like, what a sucker. I'm getting a great deal off of this guy who's going to do something completely crazy with his life. You know, imagine leaving your family and the plot of land that he probably lived on and his father had lived on, and his grandfather lived on, and his great-grandfather lived on for generations to go to this unspecified place. And then, when he finally goes and arrives at this place, we're told that he arrives as a stranger in a foreign country. I guess God forgot to tell him, oh, in this land that I promised to give you, there happen to be people living there. That's like God calling you and being like, okay, I want you to go west. Get up, pack your stuff, take your family and go. And this place that I'm going to take you to, it's called Wisconsin. You're like, dude, people live there. Like, how is this going to be my land? You know, it's occupied. Not to mention, we're told that he was living in tents, you know. So back in Ur, at least he was living in a city. He had a home. But we're told that when he arrives in the promised land, that he's living like a nomad. You know, he pops up his tent, sets up camp, and then some raiders come in, and he has to flee. Or they run out of water, and so they have to go search for a well, settle there. And so Abraham was wandering around in the wilderness. And really, this represents Abraham leaving behind his security. You know, Ur, his home, represented the place where he has security. We know that in the Genesis account, Abraham actually had large flocks, herds, him and his nephew Lot. And so in the ancient world, having a big flock of animals was a way of, it was a form of wealth. And so Abraham was probably a very wealthy person in Ur. And so he left his luxury, he left his wealth, and he decided to go and live in this land that God promised him that happened to be occupied with a bunch of people, living like a nomad. And, you know, God oftentimes will call us to give up this sense of security that we have, this security that we place in things or people. You know, for some of us, we're placing our security in a relationship that we have. Maybe it's an aspiration or a desire that we've had ever since we were young. And God will call us oftentimes away from that. But the thing is that God doesn't just call us away from things. He often calls us toward his blessing. Namely, a life that's full. Namely, a life that has close, deep relationships. Namely, to a life that has a transformed character. And so it's not like God's like, okay, I just want you to drop this thing. It's that he actually provides us something better. And that's the way God is. And the reason that he often calls us away from our sense of security is that he knows that these things that we place our security in are usually things that we place our security in, not in addition to God, but instead of him. And he knows that if we try to ground our lives, build our lives on these things that are temporal, that we look to for security, that those things are ultimately going to fail us one day. He knows that the only thing that's really going to give us security is a life lived for him. And so, essentially, God was calling Abraham away from this sense of security that he felt there in Ur. You know, and that's the way it is a lot of times. God will call us to let go of control and then to reach out and experience the blessing and promises that he has. To let go of our security. You know, when I was younger, one of the things that I was really scared to do was the monkey bars, to cross them. But it was a rite of passage, you know, so every kid had to do it. And so my dad would, you know, take me to the playground, right? Gives you an idea how old I am. It's been a long time. And, you know, I got to the platform right there by the monkey bars, and, you know, I'd put my one arm up, grab it, and then I'd reach with my other arm and grab that and then start to swing off. And then I'd just get stuck. You know, I'd look down and I'd get freaked out. You know, I looked down, it felt like it was a 50-foot drop to my death. And my dad would urge me on. He's like, you know, go ahead, just let go of one hand and reach over to the other one. And I just would refuse to do it. I was scared. And, you know, we would try this week after week until I finally got to it. But, you know, one time I was stuck there again, and my dad's like, okay, go reach for it this time, you know. And I was just crying and stuff. And he's like, this is getting ridiculous. You're like 15 years old. Get over it. You know, I think that in the same way, you know, God knows that sometimes we have to let go and reach out to experience his blessing, to experience the promise that he gives to us. And it's hard sometimes, you know. God will call us to do things that are very uncomfortable, that threaten our sense of identity, what we've built our life on. But he knows that when we do that, when we trust him in faith, that he's going to give us something much better because he promises that. We're told that he was living like a stranger in a foreign country. And so he was out there completely isolated. You know, I'm sure he had a difficult time speaking the language there, encountering all of these different people. We're told a little bit more about this as we skip forward in verses 13 through 16. The author of Hebrews offers this commentary. He says, all of these people were still living by faith when they died. They didn't receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. You know, I'm sure that Abraham, when he died, you know, he didn't even have a plot of land. When his wife died while he was alive, he purchased a small plot just to be able to bury her. And so at first glance, you know, I'm sure that Abraham's life looked like a complete waste. You know, it was characterized by way too many risks. You know, he didn't maximize the wealth, the luxury, the comfort, the prestige that he could have had in Ur. In other words, he wasted his life doing this crazy thing for God. And, you know, a lot of times people look at our lives and think the same thing. Why are they wasting their lives? They have so much potential. And yet they're doing this crazy God thing. You know, imagine what his close friends and family must have said as Abraham was gone. Maybe periodically they'd get reports back from him. They were just like, man, Abraham, he could have been something. Could have done something significant with his life. And yet at the end of his life, we're told that he dies in relative obscurity. That his life just appears as a blip on the screen, on the radar of life, and then disappears suddenly. And yet in the final estimation, in the final calculation, looking back, you know, the people who were famous, the people who were the rich, those who were the rulers, the most powerful people living during Abraham's time, are relatively unknown to us today. And yet this obscure figure who decided that it was more important to trust God than to trust what he could see, that is the comfort, security, and wealth of Ur, is somebody who has impacted half of the known world spiritually. And that just goes to show the kind of impact God can have through somebody who's willing to trust him in faith. Incidentally, this word here, aliens, as he talks about how these Old Testament figures are just kind of like these wanderers, these passerbys. This word aliens is actually the Greek word xenoi, which is the plural form of the word xenos, where we get the word xenos from. You know, a lot of people are like, what is that weird name you guys have? You know, what is that, Xerox, Xenos? I don't even know. It's really an awesome word, which means a sojourner, somebody whose citizenship is not here, but is somewhere else. And the truth is, our citizenship is not here on earth, but it's in heaven, and we're just passing by in this life. Investing in the things that we know are going to be valuable to us once we receive our inheritance. He goes on to say in verse 14 and 15, people who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they'd been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had the opportunity to return. Oh yeah. Abraham, he could have returned at any time. He knew the way back. He knew how to get back to Ur. In the same way that many of us can imagine going back to all our old way of life. We could figure out a way. Some of us actually are sitting here tonight with a plan B. I know what I can do if this whole God thing doesn't work out. And yet Abraham decided that he was going to trust in God. And thank God that he did. Because we're told instead they were looking for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God's not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So when you look at this story here, this part of Abraham's life, you know, the thing that was visible was the luxury and comfort of Ur. What was unseen was this better country, a city whose architect and builder is God. And Abraham decided to trust in the thing that was unseen, knowing that God would come through on his promises. Okay, let's look at our second story here, waiting on the son of the promise. In verse 11, we're told, by faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. So he alludes to this promise that's given in the Old Testament to Abraham. When God called Abraham, it was with a promise. We're told in Genesis 12, verse 2 and 3, this is shortly after he calls him to get up and to go. He says in verse 2 and 3, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So he says, look, get up, go, and I'm going to give you an heir. And through this heir, I'm going to bless all the nations. I'm going to make him a great nation. One problem with this, though, is that Abraham was pretty old by the time he left Ur, him and his wife Sarah. Abraham was probably 75 years old, and she was about 5 years younger. So she was 70. So, I mean, that's a problem when you're that old, right? Trying to have kids and heir. Not to mention, Sarah had been barren. She hadn't had any children this time. Well, we're told in verse 15, or in chapter 15, verse 2 through 6, so skipping ahead in the narrative, as he's out wandering and trying to conceive with Sarah, he turns to God and he says, "Oh, sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless? And the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus." He's like, "I've got this guy. He's like my, you know, third or fourth cousin. I don't even know. And he's my only heir." He says, "You have given me no children, so a servant in my household will have to be my heir." Then we're told that the word of the Lord came to him. He says, "This man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body." He took him outside. He says, "Look up into the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." You know, this is at a time when there was no light pollution. There was like no smog covering the air. You know, I remember even on a real clear night in Chicago growing up, you know, I'd go outside in the city and look up, and you know, I could see maybe like 5 stars. For those of you who are from Cleveland, it's probably way worse. But, you know, if you ever get out to like, you know, the country or something like that, where you're far away from light pollution, you know, it's amazing. You get a glimpse of just how many stars there are. And God says, "So shall your offspring be." In other words, you can't count how many stars are out there. That's how many descendants you're going to have through this one person, this one son of yours that's coming from your own body. And then we're told something amazing. Abraham believed the Lord, and the Lord credited to him as righteousness. Remember the chronology of Abraham's story. This is before any of the incredible acts of faith that he had. And it was simple belief that made him righteous before God. It wasn't that Abraham like tried his best to be a good person, to be good to himself and good to the people around him that made him gave him a right standing before God. It was simply belief, trust. And that's the same requirement that God has for us today. You know, some of us are confused about what it is that gives us this right standing before God, that makes us right before him. We think that we need to do all these really good things to please him, or that maybe we need to put some good works to offset our bad works that we've done in our life. God says, "I don't want any of that stuff. All I want is belief, trust." And then there was this long wait. So God gives this promise, and some years go by. Over 10 years go by, and, you know, God comes to Abraham. And he says, "I'm going to make you, your descendants numerous. I'm going to bless the nations through your seed." And Abraham just starts laughing. He's like, "Seriously? You know how old I am? I'm 85 at this point. This ain't going to work out." And then 15 years later, God comes back to him. And he says, "I'm going to give you an heir. Remember that promise that I gave to you a while back? I'm going to come through." Well, at some point, they got kind of confused, and Sarah decides, you know what, maybe God said that you would have this heir, but, you know, maybe it wouldn't include me. And so why don't you take my maidservant, Hagar, who's this Egyptian woman, why don't you take her and have a child? And so Abraham conceives with Hagar, and they have this boy named Ishmael. But God comes back, and he's like, no, you were wrong. It's going to come through you and Sarah. And we're told that Sarah was sitting there kind of eavesdropping in the tent. And she just starts chuckling to herself. She's like, how is that going to happen? I'm like 90 years old at this point. And we read about this funny interaction between God and Sarah. Genesis 18, verse 15, that Sarah was afraid. So God's like, did you laugh? And she's like, I didn't laugh. God's like, yes, you did. I'm sure she was like, yeah, you're right. But being like, no, I didn't, you know. Well, something amazing happens. Something that, you know, 100-year-old and 90-year-old people should not be doing. They were able to conceive. And, you know, just imagine how tough this would have been. You know, the agonizing wait, 25 years, and they ain't getting any younger. And, you know, when you're about 100 years old, trying to conceive can be a very unsavory task. You know, things are just like not working the way they should be working anymore. And yet they trusted in God. I'm not going to get into any more lurid details. I could keep going all night long. So what we have here then is a remarkable story of perseverance. You know, despite the fact that they were old, despite the fact that Sarah was barren, they persevered and God gave them this incredible blessing in their lives. It's amazing. You know, we're given a retrospective on this in Romans 4, verse 19 through 21. Where Paul says, without weakening in his faith, he faced the fact that his body was as good as dead since he was about 100 years old and that Sarah's womb was also dead. Yet he didn't waver through unbelief regarding the promise of God, but was strengthened in his faith and gave glory to God, being fully persuaded that God had power to do what he had promised. 25 years of waiting. I'll tell you what, aside from letting go of control, one of the things that I hate most is waiting for something. And yet, God says that this is one of the most important ingredients in faith. That if you want your faith to grow, then you're going to have to wait. You're going to have to learn patience. And we see that Abraham's faith at this point just grows astronomically through this incident. So again, to touch on our theme here, that the author of Hebrews has laid out in verse 1, what was seen here was the deadness of Abraham's body in Sarah's womb. You know, as Abraham's looking at himself, he's just like, what? How could this thing, this body of mine, ever produce anything living? And what about you? I mean, you know? And yet, what's unseen was God's promised son that he eventually delivered. And so it's an amazing story of how Abraham persevered in his faith and saw God come through. And that's why he says in verse 12, and so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and countless as the sand on the seashore. And so he points out, even though against all hope, God delivered his son Isaac. Today, we look back on this and God fulfilled his promises. He's like, look today that there are numerous descendants from this one man, Abraham. And that they're just as God had promised 2,000 years earlier. Okay, let's look at our last story. It's not over. There's the ultimate test of faith. In verse 17 and 18, we're told, by faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God said to him, it's through Isaac that your offspring be reckoned. And so God comes to Abraham probably, 15, maybe 20 years later. In Genesis 22, verse 2, God says to Abraham, take your son, your one and only son, Isaac, whom you love, and I want you to go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I will specify to you. Can you imagine that? So finally, he gets to enjoy life with his son, this son of faith, the son of the promise. And then God comes to him and he says, I want you to offer him as a sacrifice, this incredible blessing that I gave to you. And, back then, the law of Moses hadn't been given. That was like 500 years later. And so at this time and in this region, it was very common for people to actually offer sacrifices, human sacrifices to the gods. And so it wouldn't have been unusual for God to call Abraham to do this. Well, of course, we know that God figures out a different way. But it's amazing because Abraham actually listens. Imagine what was running through his head as this was happening, as he took his son and went on this long journey. He must have been thinking to himself, how could God take away my son? I mean, after all, didn't he promise that through him, he would make my descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and that he would bless all the nations through him? How is it now that he's going to try to take his life, that he wants me to sacrifice him? Some of us feel like we're in the same place as Abraham, where maybe there's a blessing in our life that God has given to us, and now it seems like it's in jeopardy. There's something threatening to take that away. Maybe we feel like God is calling on us to give this thing up. And it's hard. We're torn. We don't know what to do. We're confused. We're agonized. We're convinced that God gave us this blessing, and now we're not sure why he's wanting to take this away. See, God understands something that we often miss, which is that there's a danger in his blessing. That often it's easy for us to start to love his blessing more than we love him. And he wants to make sure that our priorities are straight. Because the moment that we start loving his blessing more than we love him, we're putting ourselves on shaky ground. So God may be calling on you to consider something, to give up something, whether it be a relationship, an aspiration, a career opportunity. And, he may take that from you. He may not. But what he wants to be clear on is that he is first in your list of priorities, because he knows that that's what's best for you. Well, this story continues on. He decides, okay, we're going to pack up some donkeys, take a couple servants, and he takes Isaac along with some wood, a knife, and some fire, and they start walking 3 days to this area of Moriah. Then we're told that Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he received Isaac back from the dead. And so as his mind was churning, the author of Hebrews gives us a little bit of insight into what Abraham was actually thinking on the trip there. He says that Abraham reasoned, since my son has been promised to me by God, then he reasoned that if he actually did have to kill his son and sacrifice him, that God would actually raise him from the dead. Now here's a question. How could he know that? How could he ever conclude or infer this? Well, it just happens to be there in the text. In Genesis 22, verse 5, when they arrive at the base of the mountain, he decides to leave back his two servants, and he says to them, we're going to go up to worship, and we'll come back to you. See, the author of Hebrews, he was a careful Bible reader. He noticed the plural pronoun, we. We will worship and we will come back. And so Abraham knew one way or another, whether he had to kill his son and sacrifice him, that God would either raise him from the dead or that God would actually offer something else as a substitute for his son. Well, Abraham goes up to the top of the mountain and he makes Isaac actually haul up the wood on his back. And Abraham is actually carrying the knife and the fires are going up there. At one point, Isaac asks Abraham, he said, we got the fire, we got the knife, we got the wood. Where's the thing that we're going to sacrifice? And Abraham's like, don't worry, my son, God will provide a lamb. And so when they get to the top of the mountain, Isaac offers himself voluntarily as a sacrifice. Now, that's not given to us in the text. But think about it. Even an out-of-shape 20-year-old could take on a 120-year-old man. Right? At the very least, he could outrun a 120-year-old man. I mean, if you're 20 years old and you can't outrun a 120-year-old man, you should leave right now and go work out. You got problems. And so Isaac must have volunteered for this. He must have accepted it. And so as he tied up Isaac to the stake and set the wood below him, he raised his knife, and we're told just as he was about to strike Isaac, the angel of the Lord said, wait. And the angel of the Lord often shows up in the Old Testament narrative. Most scholars think that this was actually a pre-incarnate visitation of Christ. And he points to this bull in the thicket. He says, instead, offer that. And so we're given this incredible picture of what eventually Christ would do. We're told 2,000 years later that the same angel of the Lord would put on human flesh and come in the man Jesus Christ and actually offer himself as a substitute. You know, some people say, well, if God, even if God planned to provide a sacrifice, it was really cruel for God to command Abraham to sacrifice his son. I mean, think about the 3 days of agony he must have gone through. It's just like a cruel joke. I think the answer to this is that God was playing out a divine drama that he knew would culminate in the coming of his son Jesus. That's why in verse 19, when he says, figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. This word is the Greek word parabole. And that's where we get the word parable from, which is a symbolic story that teaches us a spiritual lesson. Jesus used that very often. And in this case, Isaac was a symbolic story, even though it was a historical event, of what God would ultimately do. And that's why the New American Standard Bible renders this verse, he considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. Isaac was a type of Christ. This was all a picture of what God would do. And so even though it was agonizing, even though it was probably painful for Abraham to do this, in the long run, millions of people, maybe even billions, have looked back on this passage as evidence predicting the coming of God's Son, Jesus. Now, there are some striking parallels if you connect the dots here. You know, first of all, God stresses to Abraham, take your son, your only son. God, in the New Testament, God the Father refers to Jesus as his one and only son. Also, God sends Abraham to the land of Moriah to sacrifice Isaac. Later, we're told, 1,000 years later, then Solomon began to build the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David. Turns out, Mount Moriah was probably the site of where the temple was built. And we know where Jesus died and was crucified, right there on Mount Moriah, outside the city of Jerusalem. Also, Abraham placed the wood for the burnt offering on Isaac's shoulders, just like Jesus, who bore his own wooden cross to go to his own death. In addition to Abraham carrying the knife and the fire that they would use, God the Father would pour out the wrath, the punishment that each and every human being deserves to pay, and put it out on Jesus. That Him, the Father, and the Son were working in concert to rescue the entire human race. And finally, when Isaac asked where the sacrificial animal was, Abraham answered, "God will provide a lamb." What does John the Baptist say when he sees Jesus for the very first time at the beginning of his ministry? He says, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." And so through this incredible act of faith, we get a beautiful picture of what God would eventually do through his son Jesus. And that's why we're told that Abraham reasoned that God would raise the dead. And figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. Now, again, what was seen here is God's calling Abraham to sacrifice his son. That's what he saw, you know, from a horizontal perspective. The unseen part was God blessing countless millions, even billions of believers with such a striking type of Christ. Even the hundreds here today. Okay, let's draw some conclusions. I think the first thing is that God grew Abraham's faith by making him wait. If you're anything like me and you're impatient, guess what? The only way to grow your faith is by sitting there and waiting. As the old saying goes, if you're into God, you're into waiting. Hate that. You know, right now, you might be waiting on something. Might be hard to trust God. Maybe you're waiting on, you know, a spouse. Maybe you're waiting on, you know, a job. You've been applying to a bunch of places. You know, you can't land that job. Whatever it is, you might be waiting. Maybe like Abraham, you're waiting to have, you know, you're married, you're waiting to have a kid. It's not happening. You know, God could be growing your faith. And He will. Secondly, before all of these incredible acts of faith, Abraham believed God and it was regarded him as righteous. It was reckoned to him as righteous. And so before, you know, him boldly sacrificing his son Isaac, before waiting 25 years, Abraham believed God's promise initially, and God said, "That made you right with me." So if you're here tonight and you don't know God in a personal way, what God wants you to know is He wants to forge a relationship with you. He wants you to place your faith in what Christ has done. He's gone to great lengths to create this symbolism to give you this incredible story to try to convince you that He's real and that what His son did actually paid for your sins. And so turn to Him in faith and in humility. And God says that He will look at you as though you're righteous. He will grant that to you. Finally, Abraham didn't cling to what he could see, he clung to what was unseen. And so many of us are facing circumstances in our life that are confusing, we don't understand, and yet God promises that He's going to come through for us. Question is, are you going to cling to what's unseen? Are you going to trust in God's promises that He is good? Think back on all the ways that He's been good to you in the past. All the promises that He has fulfilled in the past. Put the pieces together. God is going to come through again. And you need to trust that. And if you're in the same situation as the Hebrews, you know, where You're living this life and you have a bunch of close friends and family members who are just questioning you, maybe mocking you. You need to realize that God has built a city for you, an inheritance that one day you will receive. And in the meantime, you're going to have to live as a stranger, a sojourner, as a xenoid here on earth. All right, why don't we spend a little bit of time in prayer here? Yeah, thanks for this awesome example of Abraham. We know that he was just a man, a human just like us, with problems and issues. And the one real redemptive characteristic that he had was that he had faith in you. And we know that that is certainly true today, that when we place our faith in you, that you can do incredible things and that you're going to give us incredible things. And so I pray, Lord, if we're struggling to believe in you and to trust in your promises, that at this moment we would just turn to you in faith and decide that we're going to go with you, and that we're going to trust what you have to say. I also pray for those of us, Lord, who don't know you in the first place, who maybe sense that they feel like they're just wandering and they're aimless and they're not really sure what their lives are all about. And yet you tell them that the only thing that's going to make them happy and give them real fulfillment and eventually eternal life is your son, Jesus. So I pray that if anyone just senses in their heart that you're calling them back to yourself, that they would take up that calling, that they would turn to you and receive the forgiveness that you freely offer through your son, Jesus. And we thank you for anyone who did that. In his name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.